Welcome back to The Fire Break. I'm Steve Wolf. As you know, The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative new strategies and technologies for mitigating the most dangerous effects of wildfire, which is when people and buildings get burnt up, bad stuff. But we're working on it. I've got an amazing guest here today. I've got John Davies, who is coming to us all the way from up north in British Columbia, which is part of Canada, for those of you who don't know, you know, the country that can't keep its smoke to itself. And welcome to the show. How are you today, John?
Very well, Steve. Thanks for having me on. It's a privilege.
John, I've checked out your career pretty extensively, and it looks like you have really kind of followed the whole tree process yourself, you know, starting out growing saplings back in the 90s, becoming a forester. When the foresters got in trouble, you learned how to manage forests. When the forests caught fire, you learned how to put out the fires. You've really, you know, had a tandem career here with the life of trees. How's that been?
Yeah, it's been very fulfilling, challenging. At this point, it seems very long. Also, you know, with the way fires are now, it's also different and new and different challenges.
And what are you seeing that's different? And when did you start to see the difference?
Oh, I think for that, I would use the analogy is when I started fighting fires with the government in 1993, my contract with them started kind of the May long weekend. So towards the end of May, one of the last couple weekends in May, and it would end in the middle of August. And if they wanted to keep us around, they'd extend us weekly or a couple weeks at a time. You know, fast forward to now, and you have crews starting in different parts of BC in February, and some of them are still putting fires out end of October, November. So this lengthening of the fire season that requires people to, you know, to have resources around for that long is a very significant change. And I think that's an indicator of, you know, just climate change and the impacts on the fire season. And then the other aspect of that is just the job has really changed in the sense that, you know, these fires are now occurring more frequently in the wildland urban interface, threatening homes, and they're also getting really big really fast and getting beyond resources and the ability to knock them down at the initial attack stage. So a whole bunch of things kind of all happening there that are creating what we're seeing, you know, on the news and YouTube videos and social media throughout the fire season, really around the world, I think.
So more fires, more intense, more frequent, and more wooey interface, possibly because more wooey, right? If you expand the perimeter of that wooey, you're going to have a larger interface between people, places, and wildland places. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. People want to go and live amongst trees. They want trees in their backyard. They want to be close to the wilderness. You know, there's always those people that are looking to live downtown, but then there are those that are just looking to escape it and move to something more rural or suburban. And there are, in BC, there are a lot of large private tracts of land immediately adjacent to these growing communities, and these developers, you know, they start to sell off these pieces of land or subdivide them and, you know, throw homes on them. And it's not always done in a responsible manner where they're creating homes that are, you know, fire hardened and low ignition risk. And so, yeah, over the last decades, we've just thrown more and more homes out on the hillside like Spartan children and said, good luck. And you know, now we're reaping what we sowed.
And so when you build your house out in one of these areas that's fire prone, with the expectation that people are going to come help you if there's a fire, you have an expectation that people are willing to put their lives at risk to come get you out of a jam that you put yourself into.
Yeah, I know that's another way that that things have changed. You know, in the past, it was just a job running out into the wilderness somewhere and you know, with a plasky and a hose and, you know, a crew full of mostly guys to put a fire out. And, you know, if you missed or you were unsuccessful, it got bigger, but it just burnt up more trees. But now we're putting people in between, you know, homes and communities and these really intense, fast moving fires and predominantly up in BC, those people on the wildland side, they're kids in university. You know, they're early 20s, late 20s, early 30s, if they're sticking around. And we're putting them in pretty traumatic situations where they're having to make very critical and difficult decisions at a very young age. That, you know, if they fail, that stuff's going to sit with them for the rest of their lives. And so I think that's also a big part of it where it's changed. And I think we're seeing some of the results of that in at least our agency's difficulty in retaining people year after year. There have been some big fire years up here, 2017, 2018, 2021, and then last year, 2023. And I know after a couple of those big years, people have just gone, not what I signed up for. I'm out of here. And so there, you know, when I joined back in the 90s, there were hundreds and eventually, you know, thousands of people applying for a couple hundred jobs a year. And now they're having trouble filling those positions or maintaining their own employees. And so people are moving up. And you're left with this vacuum underneath of like crews with very low experience or crew leaders, or people become crew leaders that don't have a whole lot of experience behind them. And then they get thrown into these big years and, you know, they're 2 or 3 years in, and maybe those were 2 or 3 quiet years. And now suddenly they're protecting a community and they have all this responsibility on them. And don't get me wrong, some are very good and rise to the occasion, but I think others just look at it and go, I'm just trying to get through university. This is good money for me and I'm just trying to get through university. And now I've got to live with watching homes burn down and whatnot.
Did Alexander the Great not conquer all of Asia by the time he was 18? I mean, maybe it sounds like, you know, well, and do you think we're expecting less and less of young people in terms of responsibility and they themselves are, you know, in that as well, or is the scale of the responsibility just too much for someone without, you know, a decade of experience underneath them?
I think a bit of both, Steve. I think you end up with people who maybe glorify the position or overestimate themselves and get in that situation and then just, you know, they're just blown away by it. I think that also, you know, I'm in my early 50s. I grew up, you know, through a time where, you know, there was this Marlboro Man, hard cowboy. You don't cry. You don't deal with pain. You just get the job done. You bury that stuff down and you kind of move on and you don't talk about it. And I think, you know, as a society, we're changing quite a bit where people aren't willing to do that or they can't do it. And so I think that also impacts where, yeah, people get out. You know, they're just trying to get through university and this looks like a fun job. And then they get into a really hectic, bad situation and they don't have the skill set or the mental aptitude to process it and deal with it. So I think there's a lot of things at play with that question.
So hard jobs and soft people might not be a great combination.
You may not know yourself until you get into that position.
Yeah. And no one is saying that, you know, the traumas that responders experience aren't real and don't require care. The question is really whether people are able to time slice. It's like right now is get the job done time and later is my PTSD curing time.
Yeah. And we obviously see that a lot in, you know, in the typical first responders of structural firefighters and police and ambulance attendants, military, on and on and on. Right. And in those where we kind of expect it and it's kind of been around it. I think it's a fairly new aspect of wildland firefighting. And certainly up here in Canada, it's a very seasonal job. As I said, you know, there's a start date and an end date and that. Whereas I think in the States, there's more people make an actual long-term career of just being on the fire line. Whereas up here, that's a rarity. People do it, right? They'll work 6 or 9 months of the year and then they'll come back and, you know, they go skiing or traveling, whatever, and that's their life, right? And they can make some pretty good money at it. Or else you get on full time with the welfare service in a management position, and you know where your winter is preparation and your summer is implementation and response. So I think it's a little bit different than you know what I understand firefighting is in the States, where it can be, you know, given that latitude, you can work, you know, maybe almost year round. I don't exactly know what the seasons are. So yeah, it's a different job up here where it's typically been a summer student job, and so that's who you're getting, summer students.
So if we had an international wildfire suppression team, this would certainly be at the very least a year-round job because it's always fire season somewhere.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. I know Canada in the last year or two has bantered around this national fire force of, you know, putting like a almost like a national guard, I guess, where something blows up, you can move people and resources to somewhere, which we already kind of do through our national agency. And I think something like that would be really difficult because they're already having trouble filling positions provincially. So now you're going to try and fill positions federally and get people to, you know, to move around in that regard. And so I think something nationally might have similar challenges, but it also might be something that works because, you know, maybe young people want to move around and work 12 months of the year on the fire line. And, you know, that might change when you want to settle down and buy a house
Sure.
and have
I mean, what I
kids.
was proposing was an international
Or international,
fire task force.
yeah. Because people are already, you know, I know they're down in Chile and I know they're down in Australia, and they have both come up. And certainly in Canada, we saw the whole rainbow of countries, you know, come up here and provide support. And you know what's going on in Chile now, and some of what was Australia, you know, people have gone down there, and not just the government, but some private sectors as well have managed to secure contracts, which I think is a fairly new thing. So, yeah, it seems like maybe there is this international opportunity now where it's not just the government, but yeah, private sectors can start to look at maybe they team up with, you know, something out of Texas or South California or whatnot. And it's like, yeah, we're going to work together to support each other, and then we're going to be able to retain people because there'll always be work.
Now, I wonder also if when you receive aid in the form of firefighters from other countries, are they providing the maximum benefit they could if you have people with a fair amount of experience coming up and then being put under the direction of people with 2 or 3 years of experience.
Yeah, my last year on the fire line was my 25th year, and it was 2017, and I ended up with my crew operating under a DIV soup that was in his third year, and somehow we got into a conversation on, hey, you know, when you start, as you do on the fire line. And it turns out I had been on the fire line more years than he had been alive, and he was in charge. And then in this conversation, it suddenly clicked in his head that that was the thing. And it was kind of like this, maybe I'll just let you do what you're gonna do and let me know if you need anything. So it's like,
Yeah,
which is
trading
great because a
places
lot
would
of,
be a great way to start, right?
yeah, a lot of people might just get in that and go, no, I'm the div soup and you're gonna do this, instead of going, well, what do you think we should do, right? Where, you know, and it becomes a discussion. So yeah, and I think the other thing with that is that you have to meet a standard when you're interagency moving resources around. So when Australia comes up, there's a standard, and the same with the States and Mexico, right? There's something that CIFC looks for, where this is what we want, and this is what we're going to pay for, and this is what we're expecting to get. And I think that that's maybe not always the case in a really, really busy fire season where, you know, Australia has a really bad year, and they go, yeah, I don't want to go up to Canada for 2 months of my winter and be away from my family and fight fires, right? Like some people will jump on that train right away, and others will go like, I'm tired, right? I'm done for the year, I'm burnt out. And so then someone maybe with less experience now gets on that train and ends up here, and they don't know the fuel type, they don't know the topography, they don't know, you know, how terrain affects fire and weather conditions and all of that. And yeah, they get paired up with something, but it might be like, it might be something that they've never seen before. And just,
well, yeah. When, you know, the military needs lots of people to go do something, they, you know, have referred to private contractors, and they pay them a lot of money, and they send them in to go do a specialty thing where they can do that, you know, quite lucratively for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years and retire. Because the financial value of achieving that goal is, at least in the mind of the government, very high. When insurance companies are sustaining these massive multi-million dollar losses, wouldn't you think that they would put up a substantial amount of that funding towards an enterprise that could minimize their losses?
Yeah, and I think that happens in California. I've heard examples of private insurance companies hiring crews, and those crews just stay with that house. And all the insurance company is thinking is, don't let that burn down, because you're way cheaper than us paying out that insurance. So I could see that starting to happen in some areas. Up here, it's when they put a evacuation order on, you're legally obligated or required to leave. And if you go out, you can't come back in. But if you don't leave, then you can stick around. So I can see some situations materializing where insurance companies start to maybe look at doing this, and they're able to get their crews in, you know, as a fire is approaching the community, and then you're there and you're self-sufficient for who knows how long, because there's no bringing supplies in. So, it would also be interesting to see like how are they dealing with the liability of throwing crews into something like what's coming at them, you know, for the sake of just saving a house.
Right? Yeah, that's probably not a great plan. lose a four-person crew to save, you know, having to buy out a house.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you look at, you know, when you look at West Kelowna, was a big fire this year in the Okanagan here where I live, and that was $720 million of insurable losses, right? Like that doesn't keep happening for too many years before insurance companies going, yeah, we can't do this. And whether that means you don't get insurance, or you're getting charged a lot for insurance, or you have to have some sort of assessment on your property, and then you to show that your house is fire hardened or fire smart, fire wise for you guys, and then we'll give you insurance. And then when you go to renew, we're going to come back and do another assessment. And if you planted cedar hedges and juniper bushes around your house and in between those two time periods, then you're not getting insured. And I really feel like, you know, I don't think insurance companies are ever going to take less money from people. I think that they'll just charge people more unless they do something, and then they'll go back to charging them the same. I've been asked before, it's like, do you think insurance companies will offer a lower rate if you fire smart your house? And it's like, no, they're going to do the opposite.
So what do you think is going to have
the
biggest impact on minimizing the destructive impact of wildfire? Is it going to be things that people do at the individual level, at the homeowner level? Is it going to be forestry policies? Is it going to be suppression strategies? You know, where's the big bang for the buck coming from?
I know the answer to this.
Great.
Yeah.
The world is waiting to know.
I know the answer to this because I saw it this summer, and I've seen it several times. Is again, referring back to the West Kelowna fire, which was called the McDougal fire. And it started about 10 kilometers away from West Kelowna, and they knew it was coming, and they knew there was a cold front that was going to push it towards the community. And so they had structure protection in place. They had plans. They had days ahead. Chief Brolin, who went to the United Nations and did an address, was telling his community, and he also got evacuated, was telling his community, this is coming at us and it's going to be bad. And it did. And it came and it hit the community hard. And since 2008, I've been doing, I'd say the lion's share of fuel management work to protect communities in the Okanagan here, and probably in the last five or six, some other companies have moved in and done work as well. So in the past, I've been quite involved with a lot of fuel management work around the community of West Kelowna. And there's also a community forest around it, right adjacent to it. And they have done a bunch of work as well. And then the District of West Kelowna has done a bunch of fuel management work internal. And so when this fire came at West Kelowna, it impacted. It went right through those treatments. And you can see the effects those treatments had on allowing firefighters to put them to stand by the homes and try and defend them, because the intensity of the fire that was coming at them through that fuel break was a whole lot less than the Crown fire that came rolling over the hill and down the slope. And as it's supposed to, it lost some intensity in these treated areas and burnt the vegetation and small woody biomass on the ground. And you can see the impacts of the firefighters, because there were so many examples of landscaping of juniper bushes that were ignited and were burning and black and nothing but, you know, the stalks of them, and then stopped. Right? There's no other reason for that fire to stop in that juniper landscaping than a person being there with a hose. Same thing with cedar hedges, half-burnt cedar hedges that were coming up between properties towards homes, right? Because they like that privacy. Boom, stopped partway up. Again, no other reason. Lots of fuel. You've got the weather. You've got the ignition. All of it. No other reason for that fire to stop in that cedar hedge besides a person with a hose. And other examples on and on like that, right? And so those two things in combination, fuel management work in the interface to lower the fuel hazard, decreasing the fuel loading that results in a lower fire intensity when the fire enters that treated area, and then treating around homes so that they have a low to zero ignition capability immediately adjacent to the home. So getting rid of anything combustible. For us, it's a meter and a half from the home, nothing combustible, and then out from that up to 10 meters, you know, no overhang branches, clean your lawn up, keep it green. No cedar hedges, juniper bushes and stuff like that. No cedar shake roofs, clean out your eaves, all that stuff. Those two things in combination are going to be what protects homes. And what failed in West Kelowna, there were a lot of successes, but what failed in West Kelowna were those old homes that had mature vegetation in their yards or in between the homes that received embers that were cast in over the fuel-treated area. And landed in cedar hedges, in juniper bushes, in dry grass, in eavesdrops, right? And you can see that where you have a slope with all this vegetation that's all burnt, and then you have a missing house right adjacent to that home, right? Those were that was how homes were lost. And then the other way is that you had private land pieces that weren't treated immediately within, you know, the treated perimeter that received embers, and that caught fire, and that brought fire in amongst the homes, like green spaces and stuff that developers had left behind. So the solution I was talking about was we have to harden homes, and if they're old homes, then we have to do that retroactively. We have to develop new homes responsibly so that they're fire smart or fire wise. They can't ignite, or it's very, very difficult. And we need to treat fuel loading and fuel hazards that are immediately adjacent to the community, so the perimeter interface, so that it will only support low intensity fire as it approaches those homes.
Yes.
And none of that is new.
Right.
None of that is new. There's FireWise, there's FireSmart, there's tons of literature, there's lots of evidence out of the states of fuel breaks working, and it's all there. There's a lack of political will at both mostly at the local government level. And then there's just a whole lot of decades of catching up on bad development. And we have a lot of land to treat for fuel management adjacent to communities. And it's expensive and it's not sexy, right? Like fire trucks and engines and aircraft and helicopters and mass water delivery systems, that all looks really good during a fire season. And that, but no one looks at someone going out in the middle of winter and picking up sticks and piling them and burning them or doing a prescribed burn or anything like that. Once the fire season's done, no one's No one's thinking about that. And so it's a very drip, drip, drip of funding to do that fuel management work. And until that changes, we're just going to keep being in the same situation. And until local governments put the emphasis on developing responsibly and making developers have to do wildfire risk assessments, mitigative treatments, and harden homes before they issue a development permit to start developing that home or that residential neighborhood.
Yeah, and there's corollaries to this, and you know, in every industry, right? That the dietitian who keeps you from getting sick with a healthy diet, you know, gets none of the glory or credit or financing, you know, that the oncologist gets when they cure the cancer you gave yourself, right?
Excellent analogy. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, and also, you know, knowledge isn't the issue, as you said. Fire smart, fire wise, fire wisdom. That doesn't exist yet, but we should. It's in your head, I know. These programs are, you know, they're no different than saying, hey, by the way, smoking is bad for you, and then thinking that, oh well, now I've cured the smoking problem. Yet, no, it's that people don't act on the information. And so the real success of any of these programs is not so much as in the content, but in the delivery, right? How do you package this information in a way that is so appealing to people that they can't wait to run out and do it? The way people started drinking those disgusting shakes when they saw Rocky preparing to fight, you know, and
yeah,
boy, you saw everyone out running and drinking raw eggs and who knows what else they were doing, you know, because the way preparing for fitness was presented in that movie, you know, motivated a whole generation. And so what do we need to do to get people to do the simple things that we already know would make the biggest difference? How do
we
motivate
well.
That? What's that?
I have the answer to this as well.
Oh, great. See, I knew you were the guy to come to.
It's just public education. It really is. There's no excuse now, as there might have been, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, not to engage in fire smart development when building, when a local government is issuing a permit for a home. There's that with social media and YouTube and everything that goes on with advertising of fire smart and fuel management and all the fire catastrophes that we've had in, you know, I'm speaking specifically to BC now, all the homes that we have lost in 2003, 2009, 2017, 2018, 2021, 2023, and you know, in a few sparse years in between, no one anymore has the excuse to not realize that fire is a threat to communities and what we need to do to change that. And there's so much research and evidence and literature about why homes burn now. You know, you take it right back to Dr. Jack Cohen and all his YouTube videos and burning houses down and stuff deliberately to see why they would burn, to, you know, this, I've seen this video of this rotating home, I think it's either Missoula or Boise, and, you know, and they're throwing showers at it and they're showing why, you know, how homes burn down. Like, that's all out there, right? There's no excuse now for us not to know why homes burn down and how fires burn into communities. We're missing that implementation piece. We're missing that political will and that funding to push people to do it, you know, whether it's a stick or a carrot. And I think there's always just been this expectation that the fire trucks and the firemen and women and the wildland firefighters are going to come and save me if a fire starts. And then the other aspect of that is there's just a lot of people that, you know, are maybe elderly and can't do the things around their homes that they need to do to make them fire resistant. And that requires some sort of, you know, probably subsidized labor force or neighbors getting together to help that person out. And until people understand that if we take our whole perimeter neighborhood and every single house is fire smart, fire hardened, so it won't burn down, we essentially have a fire break in amongst all these homes. And if you can keep one home from not burning, then there's a really good chance that that next home won't burn because, you know, you don't have houses within 10 feet of each other and radiant heat and conductive heat and all that starting the next house on fire. And as soon as you get that disaster sequence of one house, two houses. It doesn't take very long for any fire departments, particularly a small one here in BC in a rural community, to be completely overwhelmed. And I remember when I took my FireSmart course, there were a bunch of fire departments in there, and the instructor asked one fire chief that was there, says like, how many homes would you have to have consumed before your resources were tapped? And he said, one, maybe two, possibly three if I was able to call in an adjacent community, right? So that's three homes on fire. Never mind, you know, a fire surrounding your community and having multiple homes on fires in different locations. And we're lucky here in BC, and we have a whole program built around structure protection. We have crews and units, and we have, you know, they all get thrown into the incident command system, and they work with the wildfire service. But I think that there's always this expectation that someone's going to come and save me and help me. And I also think that's changing because up here in BC, and we really saw it this year, and we saw it in 2017 or 2018 up north, people didn't leave. People didn't trust the government was going to save them or that someone was coming to help them. And part of that was there was so much fire in so many areas, so much interface risk that they didn't have the resources. And so they had to prioritize fires. And so people were left on their own. And in northern BC, it was a lot of, farmers and ranchers and stuff that are very competent and have equipment and stuff like that. And so I think that's a whole lot different than someone just having a recreational property on the lake and now a firestorm's heading their way and I'm going to save my house. It's like, you have no idea what's coming at you. And then they end up in the lake. And now you're sending resources in to rescue these people instead of fighting the fire. And so I think that up here, there's a movement this year. Like it happened, there was this revolt, like this major revolt in a rural area in northern Shuswap where people didn't leave. They stayed and defended their homes. And then the police came because there was an order and equipment was missing or rumored to be missing. And it was just it was a public relations nightmare. And now there's this move to like, okay, let's look at, maybe we can start to train some of these rural communities and rural fire departments to stay and survive. Which takes on a whole liability unto itself because now you can have elderly people, people trapped, right? And now you've got to go and rescue them. So I think there's a solution there somewhere in that regards and how to use locals, but really it's going to come down to we need to educate people to change the dynamics on their properties so that their homes won't burn down.
And then to provide them, as you said, if they're not able to do the work themselves or to finance it themselves, that would be a worthwhile endeavor for a government to pursue.
Way cheaper.
Yeah. So
way cheaper.
I don't know what your election cycles are in Canada, but you know, here it's typically 4 years. And if people aren't going to see the return on that investment within the span of their political service, there's just not so much motivation to do it.
Yeah. We're similar, 4 or 5 years, depending on the province up here. But yeah, you're right. It's not, it can get forgotten. Like a fire season can get forgotten very quickly, especially if the next one's quiet. And that money that goes into prevention doesn't always show up in some sort of way that the government can show a metric for it. If it's fuel management work, you can show hectares treated or area of high risk reduced. But, that's not the same as aircraft flying around. And it's not the same as more engines showing up in a community where people can actually see that, right? And they go, an engine, I'm safe. Whereas, they don't
there,
go and look
great
out.
Use of my tax dollars, they're thinking, right?
Yeah, whereas, they go and they look at a treated stand and they go like, they don't get it.
What's right? There to see?
Yeah. Yeah, or here's money to remove the cedar hedges and change the landscaping around your house. It's like, that sounds like yard work now.
It is. Well, it's all yard work, right? Whether you're doing pre-fire mitigation or whether you're responding to a fire, which is one of the fire chiefs here referred to it as high-speed gardening. It's the same process. You just have to do it a lot faster.
There's more energy. Yeah, and it's either being done very quickly with an excavator in your yard, ripping things apart, or you can do it in a very organized and sensical way, you know, in the shoulder season, so that you're not ending up with this destroyed piece of property, right? It's like dropping a couple blades and running through the bush with dozers to try and get in front of a fire, rather than doing preventative landscape level fuel break design and implementation instead, where you go, now we've got this nice little break here and we didn't destroy the soil and vegetation and whatnot, and we maybe enhanced or restored some habitat and create a resilient ecosystem.
Yeah, no, I got that that talk from my doctor last month. He says, well, you got a little hernia here. We could schedule a procedure and we could go in and some robots could do a very clean job. Or you could wait until it's an emergency, and then they're just going to slice you open and do the best they can, and you're not going to like the results.
Yeah, another good analogy.
I said, okay, let's do the scheduled pre-mitigation.
Yeah.
Right, rather than wait for the emergency and have, very unpleasant outcome. But I think we may also need some creativity that comes from outside of the science community. Of fire science, because when you look at the FireWise, FireSmart, and in your case, FireWisdom programs, all of the facts are there, but you go pick up the brochures or you go to the website, and it has all of the appeal of a government website or a government publication, and I think people read it and they're like, okay, that's interesting, and then they move on to whatever is more interesting, going out to buy groceries or something. And no one has tied the facts to the emotions that actually cause people to take actions. You need Steven Spielberg to make a movie about the importance of pre-fire mitigation, with big movie stars that everyone wants to do what they're doing, right? To add, I don't know what you'd call it, some sex appeal. You need Beyonce to do a song about FireSmart, FireWise, right?
You can see some of that, like in those videos in the fire labs there of homes burning down with the ember shower coming at them, and you can
see great videos.
You can look at pictures. There's some great ones out of the States of like how fuel breaks have worked, showing the difference in fire behavior, and you can take people out into West Kelowna or, locally here of landscape level fuel breaks that have burnt and showed, we saved all these homes because that was there. But you're right. It's not flashy. It's not sexy. It's not, it's difficult sometimes it's difficult to relay the effectiveness, the importance of that prevention, aspect.
And what do you think about, fuel treatment with, chemical barriers versus fuel removal? Rather than cutting down all the trees to save the trees, can they be sprayed with long-term retardants that create a chemical fire break?
Short-term wise, we do that up here. We drop retardant from fixed wing aircraft and sometimes from rotary wing. I've seen it used in around some communities where there was this landscape level fuel break. I'm specifically thinking of 2021 now and the White Rock Lake fire that happened just across the lake. And we had done this big landscape level fuel break around this development called West Shore Estates, which was just this spaghetti plate of roads with homes, like 150 or a couple hundred homes. And we had done this huge treatment around it. And so they were able to protect the community, and they went in on the interface and they sprayed retardant all along that forest edge and into the forest with the expectation that, that would provide another buffer. The other thing that they did is they went down West Side Road, which is the lakeshore road that was going to be threatened at the bottom of the hill. The fire was coming down, and all the wooden power poles they sprayed with retardant. So I do think that there is something there. Certainly, we use it to build retardant lines from aircraft. It was used in that interface situation, and it was used in power poles. So, there is utility to that for sure, I think, and it's site specific.
In many cases, I would imagine you're using aerial craft to put retardant in places where it's hard to get to by roads. And if it's hard to get to by roads, there's probably not a lot of, you know, built assets there. Right. So that would be, you know, stopping the fire while it's small in the forest from, let's say, your, you know, lightning strike situation. But in the cases where you have an asset you want to protect, there's probably a road there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just need a big, powerful spray gun.
Yeah.
That's what we're working on is jet engine powered retardant dispersal technology.
Mm.
You know, that with a jet engine, you can get, you know, 100, 200 meters of finely atomized product. So it's actually a much more efficient delivery.
Right.
And then, you know, we're thinking that this could be really effective for evacuation route protection and for, you know, spraying up to, you know, 10 hectares a minute, you know, with bigger guns.
Yeah. 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 Interesting. You know, you're right. I think that I would see something like that having having utility within like a dense interface area where you can run a vehicle in there, however large it might be, or a tanker. And then, egress routes, these so many communities with one way in and one way out, and they're surrounded by private lands. So the adjacency of the road isn't treated. And now you've got, you know, radiant heat issues, or you've got, you know, trees burnt out and they're falling over across the road. I'm thinking like the Paradise Fire, the campfire in Paradise, where people were trapped on the road, right? Like so many examples of where either myself or people I've known have driven through these fire on either side of the road. And you're thinking, man, all it does is take one tree in front of us and one tree behind us, and we're stuck. So where those egress routes exist, and you have people at, you know, either end of them, or you have, you know, emergency personnel trying to get up those roads, I think being able to put like that would just add some protection and a safety margin.
I spoke with several of the fire officials during the summer in Canada, and they took it as a foregone conclusion that hundreds of small villages would be lost. They said, look, the fire's coming towards these places. We simply don't have the resources to protect them. Those towns are going to burn over. There's nothing we could do about it. Could we at least provide them a safe way out when the fire gets there? And in this case, because the task of the suppression was beyond the scope of the capabilities, the priority focus became on evacuation route hardening.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
And I don't know what the outcome of what that was. At the time when I spoke with them, they expected to lose about 400 small towns.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So I haven't heard, you know, how many were lost.
Yeah. And you know what? And when you hear something like that, like there's the loss of the structures, right? And that all has some sort of value or insurable loss to it. But then there's all that other stuff that goes on behind of like the, you know, the economic impacts of that, like where do those people go and live, and you know, have they lost their livelihood, and you know, how long to rebuild, and everything that goes along with being displaced, and even in the summer, like even if you don't lose your home, but you end up displacing people during a response because you've had to put an evacuation order on them, you know, that has social and economic impacts as well.
Good for the hotel industry.
Good for the hotel industry.
Good for the restaurant industry. You have no home to cook in.
Yeah. You know, so up here it's difficult because people come up to the Okanagan for summer holidays. And so hotels are already pretty booked during the summer. And now you're trying to, you evacuate 10,000 people and you're basically sending them away. Like go to a different community, go to family, friends. Oh, that one's on fire too. I can't go there. So now you're like, what do you do? Where do you send these people? How do families deal with that with kids, and you know, why can't I go home? And so there's social and economic impacts, not just, you know, values at risk.
So what do they do? Like you evacuate 10,000 people, there's no nearby, you know, 10,000 bed hotel that happens to have all this surplus space. Do they end up in convention centers, shelters, churches? Like if we were to track the path of these people, you know, there's a lot of tracking done by guys like Rino Roglivrieri on modeling evacuation behavior, right? So many people will go here, so many people will go there, you know, and then the timeline. but we only track that evacuation until they're out of the fire zone. You know, where do those pixels end up 2 days later, a week later?
Yeah. Yeah. We have, every community up here has training and the resources set up an emergency operations center. So they can declare a local state of emergency, their EOC jumps up, and then they have emergency support services or ESS. And so when people get evacuated, they get directed to go somewhere and sign in. And as soon as they do that, then they become eligible for some level of funding to help them out. But then they also either get, they register as to where, you know, a hotel they're going to go in, or they're going to go stay at families or relatives somewhere. Right. And so they just disperse. And that's all right if you don't have your whole province burning down and everyone's dispersing and trying to figure out where to go, because you're right. You can't, you know, I think at Williams Lake in 2017, I think it was, the whole community was evacuated because there was just fire everywhere around it. The whole, like, they went north, they went south. Those are the only kind of directions to go in Williams Lake. But yeah, they just scattered and they go to these other small communities that maybe aren't capable of dealing with that influx of people. So it's a challenge for sure.
And when they scatter, you know, do they come back? I mean, they're the whole town may be gone. There's no assurance that you're coming home to anything besides burn scar.
Well, Lytton burned down a couple of years ago up here, right? A whole town gone. Old Gold Rush town that was just old homes, built on an old First Nation, like, community, old village. And it started next to the railway track. It was never determined whether it was a train or not. But Jack Cohen that came up and another couple guys, they did a whole study of it. And it just moved through the town so fast, all grass-fed fire, and just ripped through. And the Lytton is in the Fraser Valley, so crazy hot winds, like 40 degrees. I think it was almost, it had been 50 degrees. We had a heat dome, so it had been 50 degrees in Lytton for a couple days.
And for my audience, that's 50 Celsius.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just, let's just say, it's really hot.
Yeah, it's really hot.
More than 100 Fahrenheit.
Yeah. And big winds, right? So the Fraser Canyon is a very narrow, it's a canyon. And so the winds just rip up there. And it retains its heat because of all the you know, the rock cliffs and whatnot. And it just rolled through the village. And there was nothing anyone could do because it moved so fast. And it was all old wooden homes. And, you know, here we are several years later, and it's, you know, it's still being rebuilt. And so those people have been out of their homes for, you know, X number of years, like 3 or 4 years now. This total village gone.
Right. And the assumption that, like, well, it doesn't matter, I'll evacuate and the insurance company will write me a check and I'll come build a new house. You know, good luck with that. If you think the fire market is scarce, you know, good luck with finding the labor to rebuild 1,000 homes in the community. You know, you're looking at a five-year project.
Did you even have insurance?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And if you've got replacement value or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or what, and, right? You know, a lot of people don't have the insurance coverage that they think they have, simply because what they think they have is what they imagine they have. But they've never actually been able to dive through their policy or have someone explain what's covered and what's not. Yeah. Whether you have relocation expenses, et cetera.
Yeah. And I don't know how it works for you guys, but if there's a forest fire in the vicinity of a community up here, you can't buy insurance. They won't, like, if you just bought a home and you cannot get insurance for that home until that fire is out and gone and no longer a risk. They won't even touch it. So you can end up in limbo, or your insurance needs to be renewed. And it's like, well, sorry, we're not, there's a fire over there. Right.
Oh, so yeah. My policy notice, you know, showed like a 5X increase from one year to the next.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, but if you have a mortgage, you don't have a choice, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You lose, right.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Last question. Let's say you could get a lifetime appointment and therefore be able to make decisions without political consequence as the fires are, you know, what commands are coming out of your office?
You know, I think a very easy answer to that is a funding focused one. To the way we do things up here is we fund projects. So we'll fund a fuel management project, and maybe it's 10 or 20 hectares, and you know, we have to do a prescription, and that gets signed and sealed by a professional that says it's going to do what it's going to intend it to. And then we go and implement it, and then we move on to another one. And so we end up with these very small continuous projects, but they take a lot of administrative time and money to bring to fruition. And we don't treat things as a program where we go to a community and go, give us a five-year plan of how you're going to protect yourself, both for fuel management and internally for fire smart work. Tell us what's going to cost, and we'll look at it, we'll review it, and we'll fund it. And so now you know what you have for 5 years. And that might be more attractive to a contractor because they'll realize, oh, hey, there's $1 million worth of work here. So I'm going to realize economies of scale, and I'm going to be able to hire people and train and buy equipment, and therefore I'm going to give you a lower cost per hectare. But because we have a very finite amount of, and we're kind of moving a bit in that direction with some multi-year funding now, but because there's a finite amount of money in the pot, every community can't go and do that because there'd be no money left. So really it comes down to money is the problem. So I would say very superficially, somewhat, go put $1 billion in the pot. Go put $1 billion in the pot and let's really tackle this seriously, doing the stuff that we know needs to be done. And just say, you know, we're going to pay for it eventually, whether it's over a number of years with subsequent funding, or we're going to pay for it in a bad way of people losing their homes. But either way, we're going to pay. So let's pay in a favorable manner. Put that money aside and go, here, this is $1 billion. We expect results, right? And have a big accounting firm be there that's going to be, you know, keeping track of, like, you know, accountability. And then, you know, turn it over to the communities because they know how to manage projects. They do it all the time with roads and other capital projects, guidelines in place and stuff like that. But give them the money they need to make a difference, because right now it is really just a drip. And we have so much to do and a very small amount of money to access to try and do what we need to do.
Yeah, it sounds like they have an ADHD approach right now. Oh, let's do this. Oh, let's do that. Oh, let's do the other thing. With no real plan for how it all fits or ability to have a master view for prioritizing, you know, what actions are going to have the most impact and starting there and working backwards.
When we have a fire season up here, we have an indirect budget, which basically hires everyone to be around to go fight fires. And then when a fire starts, they have exact access to something called a direct budget, which just doesn't run out, right? Go and spend whatever you have to do to deal with this fire season. We're going to keep the money flowing. That's not the same with the prevention thing, right? So we're having fire seasons now that are almost costing $1 billion in suppression costs. So if we know that this is going to be happening year after year, let's take that $1 billion and let's pump it in up front to preventative measures and go, here it is. This is a 10-year plan. It's a 5-year plan, or, you know, something like that, like something aggressive, and go, yeah, here it is. Now you no longer have the excuse of funding. So if this doesn't work out, it's something in the system.
Right. And there'll be problems with the system, and there'll be. You know, inefficiencies, and there'll be misdirected funds, and there'll be stuff stolen, whatever. So what though? Like it's going to save lives. It's going to save homes. And in the long run, so much cheaper.
Yeah. I think it's difficult for politicians because there's, you know, there's homelessness, there's drug overdose, there's all these other pressures on them to deliver money elsewhere that can show bigger bang for buck, or is flashier on the news or whatever. You know, this, we built this many homes rather than saying, hey, we treated this many hectares. So
train home, you know, in many cases, the physical job of mitigate, rake the leaves, take away stuff away from the houses, you know, treat the fuels, remove some dead lumber. Like, these are things that homeless people could be trained to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not, in many cases, highly skilled labor.
No.
So there you go. We can solve two problems at once. John, I knew you'd be the guy to come to for the right answers.
Only people would listen to us, eh?
There you go. Excellent. Well, we got to wrap up. John, it's been an amazing conversation with you, and I definitely know we want to pick this up again. I hope you'll come back on the fire break so we can continue.
Yeah, anytime, Steve. I enjoy talking about it, and it's been a great conversation. So, yeah, reach out anytime. I'm happy to jump back in on something.
And for people who want more information directly from you, what's the best way to reach you?
They can get hold of me at my email address, which is jdavies@foresight.ca, Davies and foresite.ca. I'm on LinkedIn, so it's one of those two methods.
Well, thank you so much again. All right, folks. Well, you've been enjoying, hopefully, another hour of the fire break, where we're going to keep talking about this until enough people know about it that something gets done about it. The fire break is sponsored by Team Wildfire. We're developing new techniques and technologies for mitigating the worst effects of fires. Thanks so much for joining me, and we'll see you again next time. Take care.